hear that unmistakable beat, ladies and gentlemen, that unmistakable sound, and you know that's the late, great Waylon Jennings. That's something from 84, as joining us now on the program, Michael Streisguth, author of Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. Michael, first of all, I want to thank you for joining me, and we came in there with a little bit of Waylon Jennings live, and Waylon's sound, it's so rock and roll. It's so accessible to so many folks, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I think that's part of his great appeal. And his drummer, Richie Albright, called that sound a cast-off of the Buddy Holly rhythm. And Waylon, of course, worked with Buddy Holly back in the 1950s, and he really began to thrive in the 70s when he let that rock and roll flow freely through his music, and that's the Waylon that we know today. Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Oh, listen, it's wonderful spending a few minutes with you. In fact, I've got to tell you, I want to congratulate you on your work. I couldn't put it down. You know, I read it. I had a trip that I took across the country, and I brought the book with me. And it's funny, you read a book like this, and there are a lot of people out there who love that style of music, love that kind of music, that era, that period. And there's something timeless about it, isn't there?
Well, there is. You know, I think that attitude never gets old. I mean, people like a little bit of cussedness in their music. Of course, as you say, that the music has never died. That outlaw sound, that outlaw music that was so strong in the 1970s. To me, it sounds fresh. It sounds like it was made yesterday. There's just nothing dated about it. And a lot of the new guys in country. I'm thinking about Jamie Johnson and folks like that, Zach Brown. I mean, in my mind, they're reaching for that Waylon sound and that Willie Nelson sound.
Yeah, but I don't, you know, and I'm not going to pick on new country. Certainly, there's different schools. I don't know if those guys find it because it's almost as if these guys happened upon it organically. And your book talks a lot about that. Willie had some false starts to his career. Waylon had some records that just did miserably, though he had great promise. And those guys almost found themselves through the back door, didn't they, in the industry?
They did. And, you know, it was also, though, an industry that would be patient with artists. In other words, the whole 1960s, when Waylon Jennings and Willie Nelson are trying to find themselves, are trying to get their footing, they were on RCA Records. They were on a major label. And even though they weren't selling millions, the label kept them around. They didn't quite know what to do with the label. The label didn't quite know what to do with Waylon and Willie. And it wasn't until they had the time to start recording the music the way they wanted to record it. I think that sound, that timeless sound that we're talking about, emerged. And that's when, of course, they started selling millions of records. And, you know, to his credit, a former record executive said, you know, sometimes the executives really don't know the best next thing for an artist, but you got to let the artist take the lead. And when that began to happen for Waylon and Willie, that's when their careers took off.
Michael Streisguth is our guest today on the program as we talk today about his work, Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. And, you know, Michael, you've also written extensively about Johnny Cash. You've done stuff about the country scene at large, and you've done a ton of things. So let me ask you this. As you sat down and you started to work on this project, give me a couple things that you learned that you thought were really interesting that you learned while putting this together.
Well, you know, I think the big thing for me was really getting to know Waylon's music a lot better. I mean, I certainly have always been aware of Waylon's career and his hits, and you know, to me, getting into the nuances of Waylon's music, giving it a harder listen, trying to understand it better, just gave me so much greater appreciation for what he was doing. I mean, with Waylon, so much of it was the image. You know, he was the swaggering outlaw guy who, you know, who really seemed like he might be an outlaw. The long shaggy hair, of course, the arrest for cocaine in 1977. But he was really a sensitive, you know, on the ball musician who really, I think, pushed out the barriers in country music. So that was huge. And I got to tell you, it was the movie Crazy Heart with Jeff Bridges that inspired me to write the book. I mean, to me, Jeff Bridges seemed so much like Waylon Jennings in that film. And Waylon, by the time that film had come out, I mean, Waylon had passed maybe 7 or 8 years before, and I was thinking to myself, you know, Waylon is fading somewhat from the national consciousness. It's not like Johnny Cash, who's bigger today than he was when he was alive, and so I began to pursue a Waylon Jennings biography, and that's how it kind of spread out. It opened up into this whole outlaw story. So that was instructive for me. And I have to say, as far as other surprises, the fact, and this gets us over to Kris Kristofferson, who really helped revolutionize songwriting in Nashville. Bob Dylan came to Nashville to record in the mid-1960s, mm-hmm. and Kris Kristofferson had arrived just out of the Army. And Kristofferson was pushing a broom in the studios of Columbia Records. He was making, you know, a few bucks an hour as a janitor. And Kristofferson is in the studio working when Dylan comes to Nashville to do his first album, Blonde on Blonde. And it just what a great moment. And you got this guy Kristofferson who actually brings kind of a Dylan vibe to the recording scene, to the songwriting scene in Nashville, actually there when Bob Dylan comes to Nashville for the first time to record. I thought that was very interesting.
I did as well. Another thing I thought was really interesting as well about the book was how it was set in Nashville, but these guys all sort of came to fruition and struggled and paid their dues at a time of, as we know in our country, great unrest. But even at a time where down there in West End, the bohemian scene, a lot of the things that were going on, you really paint the picture there of a culture that helped grow these guys in a lot of ways, into the musicians and to some degree the poets and the artists that they became. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you point that out, because I don't think Nashville gets credit for being an incubator that nurtures talent. I mean, it seems to be painted as the industry town that kind of that turns artists into stars. And while that's true to some extent, there was this great scene, as you point out, in the West End that began to emerge in the late 1960s. And it had everything, for example, that Greenwich Village had in New York. A university, Vanderbilt, a big park, Centennial, where people could hang out and play music, cheap rents, diners, clubs, you name it. And so this bohemian atmosphere rises up, and so many people, young people, were flocking to that scene. I mean, these were students at Vanderbilt, but also young songwriters and musicians who had heard that Dylan recorded in Nashville, that Neil Young recorded in Nashville. that the Johnny Cash Show, which many people were sitting home and watching on ABC, was staged and produced in Nashville at the Ryman Auditorium, that all these bluegrass bands that were showing up at universities all across the country in the 1960s, as kind of part and parcel of the folk revival, were based in Nashville. So there was this aura really about Nashville. It was every bit as creative as Greenwich Village or the Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco. And you're right. There is a studio. It's run by Tom Paul Glazer. He called it Hillbilly Central. It was the Glazer Sound Studios. And Tom Paul Glazer had been around country music for a while, but it also kind of conformed to this anything goes bohemian vibe in the West End. And, you know, the place was open all day and all night, and there was a free and easy kind of vibe. And Waylon negotiated a contract with RCA that let him record wherever he wanted to record. And he chose Tom Paul Glazer. And it was that vibe, that free and experimental vibe, that really helped Waylon wake up. And also Willie Nelson. I mean, people recall Willie Nelson hanging out on the lawn outside of the Glazer Brothers studio. Willie was playing at clubs. Kristofferson hadn't happened yet as a songwriter and an artist, but he was traipsing the sidewalks and soaking up the scene, and then going home and writing all about it. So when you hear Sunday Morning Coming Down or To Beat the Devil, these are songs, big songs by Kristofferson, that's all from his experiences living in the West End. And so that to me was just about the most fun I had writing the story. One, because the story has not been told to a great extent, and two, I just met so many interesting characters who were living in that world back in the late 60s and early 70s.
And your writing, as is the case with folks who are gifted at writing, you took me there. So congratulations to you. I found myself thinking, you know, what a fascinating place that must have been, against all the unrest that was going on in the country, the protesting, the things surrounding the Vietnam War, just the way that the mores and a lot of things were changing in the late 60s. And here is a tug of war going on as well between the establishment and these guys that, you know, we don't really know who they are yet when you talk about some of these guys that came to define the outlaw movement. But I think it would be good to point out here that when you talk about Tom Paul Glazer and the fact that he had his own studio, up until that point in time, if you wanted to do business with the folks in Nashville, and specifically, as you were talking about, RCA, you had to do business with Chet Atkins, his musicians, his producers, those folks. Talk about the heat that existed between Chet Atkins and also Waylon, two very strong-willed guys.
Yeah, I mean, as you point out, if you were signed to a record label in Nashville in the 1960s, it was a lot like being signed to a Hollywood studio in California. In California, you made the movies, if you were an actor, that the studio wanted you to make. You worked with the directors, the actors, I mean, everything was controlled. The same thing in Nashville. Waylon Jennings basically took his cues from Chet Atkins. He recorded, Chet chose the songs, he chose the background musicians, you name it. He controlled what the album covers would look like. And Waylon began to resent this. Now, you know, Waylon would say that he never resented Chet personally, that Chet was a very likable person. He always liked him. But he resented that authority, just as Willie Nelson resented that authority. And he was actually just about to give up recording. This is what his drummer told me, Richie Albright. And he had, Chet was always after Waylon about his pill taking, and that was the cause of a lot of tension. And Waylon often didn't show up for promotional events, visits to radio stations, things of that nature, and it was somewhat frustrating to RCA. But his records were not really selling, and he was going to go back to Phoenix. Of course, Waylon is a Texan, but he had had a lot of success at this club in Phoenix before he was signed to RCA. He was going to do some sessions, and his drummer said, "No, wait a second. I know a guy, an accountant in New York, who can help you. And his name is Neil Reschen." And Neil Reschen managed Miles Davis's career, and he takes over Waylon and Willie's career and kind of barges into RCA and negotiates a contract that is very beneficial to Waylon. It allows Waylon his artistic freedom, and he negotiates the same kind of contract for Willie a little bit later when Willie finally leaves RCA and goes to Columbia Records. But all of a sudden, the world kind of opens up to these guys. I mean, all they wanted to do was make the music the way it sounded on stage when they did concerts. And finally, that's what they were able to do. And this turned Nashville upside down, because in their wake, everybody began independently producing their records. And the big studios went from being the owners of controllers of the recording process to merely being a marketer of the music that the artists made by themselves. So all of a sudden you have studio engineers who are out of jobs. The record companies sell their studios. So this was big. I mean, these guys really had a big impact on what the industry looked like. By the end of the 1970s, into the 1980s, the way business was done in Nashville had really changed.
Yeah, it's really important, too. I think for people to understand that, as we visit today with Michael Streisguth, the book is called Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville. And, these are three central figures, but there are so many other folks that you write about in there, like Emmylou, Rodney Crown, some others, Kinky Friedman, some other folks that you talk about in the book. But I think it's important for folks to really understand, and take me back here to when Waylon records a few things. They don't sell. They don't really sound like him, his early recordings. And you point that out in the book. They don't really sound like him or what we came to know of his sound. And the same with Willie. Willie's stuff's a little bit aimless. I've got a couple shows from Willie back in the 60s, and they don't even sound like him. I don't know what he's going for, but whatever it wasn't really working for him. How are they able to get the type of freedom that they got when they didn't really have the bona fides of being able to point to the fact that they had sold some records? How do you explain that?
Yeah, I think that has something to do with the times. As you have pointed out, the times were changing. Society was changing. Artistic experimentation, protest against authority was becoming a given. It was becoming almost a cliche in those times. And you had some younger people who were coming into RCA. Ronnie Light, for example, is a young producer who's at RCA, and he takes the reins of Waylon's production, and all of a sudden you start seeing new blood rushing into Waylon's sessions. So it's not the same old instrumentalists, for example. Waylon wanted to use his own band members, and Ronnie Light let that happen. He begins bringing Kris Kristofferson songs to Waylon to record. So there's an openness to some experimentation. Felton Jarvis, who's known as Elvis's producer at RCA for such a long time, he begins producing Willie Nelson and also some Waylon Jennings songs. So there is some fresh blood at the studio who recognizes that if you just give these guys a little bit of wiggle room, they're going to be able to thrive. There was another guy, I believe him to be a great visionary. He's still living in Nashville. His name is Fred Foster. He was the owner of Monument Records and the Combine Publishing Company. And whenever I go to Nashville, I get this T-shirt, and I wear it, and it says, "Put Fred Foster in the Hall of Fame." And Fred Foster was the first person to really figure out what to do with Roy Orbison after Roy Orbison had been at Sun Records, at RCA. Nobody did anything with him until Fred Foster did. That's when he has his big hit. He signed Dolly Parton first, and he also signed Kris Kristofferson. Mm. And he saw Kristofferson's potential in the young folk rock audience of 1970 America. And you see, Waylon and Willie, they had been marketed to the old line country audience. New blood at RCA started thinking about ways to bring these guys, also Waylon and Willie, just like Chris was seeing, to a younger audience. So there's really kind of a new awareness that I think helps these guys. Even though, as you point out, they didn't have the track record, there were people who saw the potential in where these guys were going. And of course, Willie goes down to Austin and sees that this is also in the early 70s that he's kind of a god in Austin. And he sees the way these cosmic cowboys are dressing. They're growing beards. They're wearing plaid shirts and jeans and tennis shoes. Mm-hmm. And so Willie kind of taps into that. And you see the transformation of Willie Nelson. He goes from looking like in the 60s to a used car salesman to the what I say in the book is the spiritual leader of a back to nature pod. I mean, it's really astounding. And so Waylon is able to tap into that as well.
What I think's interesting too, and I'm telling you this, I wish I had it near me, but the show I have from the 60s featuring Willie, it doesn't sound like him. And as I was reading your book, I realized why it didn't sound like him, because he wasn't Willie yet. Mm-hmm. And you talk about how he goes through this metamorphosis and finds himself. But I think the biggest surprise to me in this book, I'm originally from Pennsylvania. I wasn't raised around country music, and I've come to appreciate it in recent years. And it's specifically the old school stuff. And I never really understood why the quote unquote old school crowd was so beholden to this music until it was recently that I've started listening to it and hearing this amount of soul that is in this music, and particularly these guys, this stuff that you deal with, all the different artists that you talk about in this book, from the Rodney Crowells of the world to the Billy Joe Shavers and some of these other secondary folks, there's just so much soul in this music. But here's my point. The whole outlaw movement, and it was a movement, happened accidentally. But anytime anything happens in a corporate sense, you've got to figure out a way to monetize it. And Nashville really didn't know what they had, but then they were able to monetize it. And you talk about how the term outlaw came into existence. And I think a lot of people would be shocked to realize where the term outlaw country came from. So tell the story, Michael.
Sure. As I said, Waylon was associated with Tom Paul Glaser, who had his own booking agency, and Waylon had hooked up as part of that booking agency. And Hazel Smith, who went on to be a well-known columnist for Country Music Magazine, and she was working as an administrative assistant in the studio at the time. And she got a call from a disc jockey in North Carolina who was promoting one of the Waylon shows there. And he says, "You know, what do you guys call this music anyway?" And so she takes out this dictionary and she's looking through it and she sees the term Mustang or Maverick, and she says, "Ah, you know, that doesn't quite do it." But then she sees outlaw, you know, living outside the written law, and she says, "You know what? That kind of sums it up. That's what these guys are doing, and you know, they're making their own rules in music, and that's how the outlaw thing started. She calls him back and says, well, it's outlaw music. And the next thing you know, these guys are booking out on tours and package shows as the Outlaws. And Jerry Bradley, who is the A&R man, the top A&R man at the time at RCA in Nashville, he, you know, this guy knows how to sell records, and he wants to, well, let me backtrack for a second. 1975, Willie Nelson records his masterpiece, or one of his masterpieces, Redheaded Stranger, and it sells millions. And so the next thing you know, Willie is just out of this galaxy. Jerry Bradley is trying to figure out a way to do the same thing for Waylon. And so he takes some of his old tracks that were recorded by Willie at RCA, and he puts them with some old tracks of Waylon's, and he brings Jessie Coulter, who's Waylon's wife, puts her on the album. She's just had a big hit called I'm Not Lisa. And then Tom Paul winds up on the label and on the album, and Jerry Bradley calls it Wanted the Outlaws. And that album, even though it was just a bunch of old songs repackaged, was country music's first million-selling album. And that is really when the outlaw tag goes international. You know, all of a sudden, Waylon and Willie, particularly along with, say, David Allan Coe, and you talked about some others, Billy Joe Shaver, even Guy Clark, these people were known as outlaws. And it's funny, if you look at the spine, I have it, you know, sitting here in the office I'm talking to you from, if you look at the spine of the album, Wanted the Outlaws, it says Outlaws, and it says / Waylon. So this was a Waylon album. This album was all about Waylon. But in the end, it accomplished what Jerry Bradley set out to do. You know, Waylon became a huge touring act. I mean, he was out playing with the Grateful Dead and New Riders of the Purple Sage, and others, particularly Southern rockers, and the album worked. The strategy worked for Waylon. So, you know, it is a marketing story. It was born of trying to figure out a way to sell more records for Waylon.
And that's the thing I love about it, because, like a lot of these movements in music, people buy into the fact that they think it's on the outside, when really it's as much on the inside as anything. And the only thing I can compare it to in contemporary times is a lot of this hip-hop music. These kids think, oh, this stuff is just so on the outside of these companies. And when really it's just, it's packaged. And I hate to compare anything as, in my mind, timeless as a lot of this music to a lot of that tripe that's being produced now. But that was just a thought that came into my head. Please excuse me. As we're visiting today with Michael Streisguth, he is the author of Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville, available from IT Publishing, and you can find that book anywhere where fine books are sold, Amazon.com. And let me tell you something. You want to talk about a great Christmas present for somebody with Christmas right around the corner. This is a great Christmas gift idea if you have any kind of music lover, country music lover, in your life. Michael, let me ask you this as we talk here. Waylon seems to, and even in your book, but even in this movement as a whole, he seems to be the star. You were just talking about that when it came to looking on the spine, and it's ironic because that was the next thing I was going to ask you. What was it about him that you feel like made him sort of the guy that was the Pied Piper of this type and this genre of music? And then also, what about Waylon in terms of how he embraced being the guy? Because he cuts a sort of a tortured soul in your portrayal of him.
You know, I think, first of all, Waylon is the star. He's the top dog outlaw. He's the guy who really fits the archetype that Nashville is selling. I mean, here's a guy who appeared dangerous The Hell's Angels were his were his security on the road. He was very public about his rebelliousness. I mean, he was constantly interviewed talking about how, you know, he does things his way and he doesn't let anybody get in his way. And so there's this image out there. And of course, the great thing about Waylon, and this is one of the reasons I really love Waylon, is that he knew he was being marketed as the outlaw, and he knew that it was a trend. He knew it was just another marketing gimmick, and that pretty soon there was going to be another marketing gimmick to replace his marketing gimmick. And he records, I mean, starting back in the early 70s, he writes and records the song, Are You Sure Hank Done It This Way? Which really, it kind of questions country music and the direction that it's going. And then in 77, 78, this is after he's busted for cocaine, he writes and records, Don't You Think This Outlaw Bit's Done Got Out of Hand? And so he's questioning this phenomena that had really become just another marketing label, and was reflecting on it, and in a way, kind of putting the brakes on it. Willie got out of there too. Willie was not going to live under the umbrella of this outlaw marketing thing, and he very quickly, you know, by 1978, he has shed the outlaw business to become kind of his own subgenre in country music. So he plays to the image, Waylon does, for a long time, and I think to some extent would continue to throughout his whole life. But at the same time, he questioned it, and in public, didn't appear to take it all that seriously. And I think. I find that very endearing, and you know, the indication of a real dynamic personality that he was.
Yeah, and just a larger than life personality, and you know, the thing about when the kind of following that guy had, and to some extent that Willie still has, in order to do that later in your career, you have to deliver on stage. It isn't just about records. You know, at some point, you have to deliver on stage, and both of those guys, and to some extent, Kristofferson as well, there's a charisma about all of them, but there's a lot of ability there too, isn't there?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, these guys were just, they were old pros. I was watching an Austin City Limits episode online today with Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell together. Mm-hmm. And they just do it so well. They've been doing it for years, and they know how to reach the audience, and they know what songs to kind of pull up out of their pocket to fit the mood. And I think that's part of the genius. You're exactly right. It's delivering on stage. And Willie has never ceased to be able to do that. And Willie's always full of surprises. I mean, you don't know who he's going to record with next. He might do something with Toby Keith, and then he does something with Wynton Marsalis. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's what I think has kept Willie fresh. I mean, Willie has never fallen into formula. I mean, you know, he's his own franchise in a way, but he's never fallen into formula. He's never rested on his laurels. And another thing about, somebody was explaining this to me, who's in the book. It was actually Hazel Smith, the woman who coined the term outlaw. She said to me that, you know, Waylon never trusted people. He was always suspicious. He didn't trust reporters. He didn't maybe have the most patience with fans, for example. But Willie would do whatever you wanted him to do. Willie, if he had time, he'd do the interview. He'd hang out outside the bus and have a beer with fans who brought a six-pack up to him. And Hazel believed that Waylon's lack of trust of people kind of kept him back. That if he had been able to trust people more, then he might have risen to the levels that Willie reached. I mean, remember Willie in the 1980s was a perennial platinum seller. It was unreal how popular he was. Waylon, by the 80s, on the other hand, his star was beginning to dim, and I think that is a just a, it's a testament to I think Willie's approach to the business more than anything else that explains, you know, why he's still where he is today.
Yeah, he cultivated it. And he's and he's a real gracious guy, you know. I think it seems like, anyway, in any walk of life, you know, hey, it doesn't cost anything. My father once told me it doesn't cost anything to smile at somebody. It's free to be gracious and to be nice to anyone. On the way out here, Waylon seems to me, from your portrayal, and again, I haven't read a lot on Waylon, and you know, I'm going on what you wrote here, but it seems to me that this is a guy who was, for the most part, haunted, even though I don't know if he articulated it or not, but was haunted by the fact that he wasn't on that plane with Buddy Holly. Share that story for folks that may not be familiar.
Yeah, this goes back to the late 1950s, and Waylon was actually touring with Buddy Holly. Buddy Holly's Crickets had disbanded, and so Waylon was playing bass for Buddy Holly, and they were on tour in the Midwest, and they were traveling as part of a package with some other rock and R&B acts, and they were on this old broken-down bus. The heat wasn't working. It was the middle of winter, and a few of the guys rented a plane to get to their next gig, and Waylon was one of the guys, along with Richie Valens and the Big Bopper, who rented this plane. And Buddy Holly came up to him and said, "You know, Waylon, can I have the seat on the plane?" And Waylon says, "Sure, go ahead." And as they're parting, Buddy says, "You know, I hope your old bus crashes." And Waylon says, "I hope your plane crashes." And, of course, it did. That was the day the music died. We lost all three of those artists along with the pilot of the plane. And, you know, that did haunt Waylon. And I was talking to one of his guitar players, Gordon Payne, who toured with him in the 1970s. And he said, you know, sometimes at night, Waylon would just start talking about that and wondering why it wasn't him, why it was Buddy, why it wasn't him. And Gordon would say, "Waylon, you know, it just wasn't your time yet. I mean, don't obsess on this. It just wasn't your time. It's not your fault that this happened." And so it did haunt him. And I think it also haunted him that, for example, that he wasn't as popular as Willie Nelson. Yeah. I think there was some professional jealousy that would gnaw away at him. So Waylon had several things gnawing away at him. There were several ghosts haunting him throughout his career.
Well, you know, you think about the three guys that you think about, the triumvirate that defined this genre. Christofferson became a big, huge Hollywood-type figure. Willie Nelson became a gigantic seller in the 80s, as you talked about. And Waylon sort of got left behind. And really, it's left to folks like us to discover, and in your case, rediscover the genius that this guy was.
Yeah. And thank God for recordings. They keep these artists alive and help us appreciate them. And sometimes Waylon could be his own worst enemy. I interviewed Jack Clement, who sadly died back in the spring. Mm-hmm. But Jack Clement produced Waylon on the great "Dreaming My Dreams" album of 1974, and Jack Clement told me that the television producer who was in charge of the Grammys, Grammy Award television broadcast, wanted to put together a Waylon Jennings, a weekly Waylon Jennings variety show in the 70s. Now, it seems kind of like a strange fit, but nonetheless, there was an opportunity there, and he had found a sponsor, I think it was Ford Motor Company, to get behind Waylon. And every time there was a meeting scheduled, Waylon would either not show up, or he would show up half-crocked. And so this opportunity that he would have had to reach this very broad audience just disappeared. And so although he may look back on it, he may have looked back on it and said, you know, I'm glad I didn't do a variety show in the 1970s. It did keep him the audiences that Willie and Chris were able to reach.
Michael Streisguth, we're about out of time here. I want to thank you for joining us today. And again, the book's called Outlaw, Waylon Willie, Chris, and the Renegades of Nashville from It Books. I'm going to give you the opportunity, we do with the folks that appear, to have a final word here. So anything maybe that we haven't touched on, maybe a point you want to reiterate, I would like to go ahead and give you the floor.
You know, we've been talking about rediscovering Waylon. And I really want to urge people to try to hunt down a song that Waylon recorded in the late 1970s called Billy, which was written by Tony Joe White. And it's a lovely song about these two old rum runners, good buddies, friends, pals, who are going their separate ways because one of them now has a wife or a woman waiting back home. And it's so poignant because at the time, Willie Nelson was becoming the huge Willie Nelson that we know now. And he was in a way leaving Waylon behind. And Waylon had also become somewhat disillusioned with the outlaw movement. And so he was parting ways from the outlaw movement. And to me, the mood and the message of the song really sum up where Waylon was at the time. It's called Billy, written by Tony Joe White and released in 1978.
That sounds like great advice. And Michael, again, thank you. Congratulations on the book. And by the way, I meant to ask you, when you told me that you were wearing that T-shirt around Nashville, which said what again? What did the T-shirt say?
It said, "Put Fred Foster in the Hall of Fame."
Now, how many people in modern-day Nashville recognize that shirt and give you two thumbs up?
A handful. Not very many, but a handful. He was really kindred spirits with Jack Clement, who was a great visionary and experimenter. And I figure if they put Jack Clement in the Hall of Fame, which they just did in the past year, there's hope for Fred Foster.
Michael, again, thank you. There's always hope, my friend.
Thank you.
Michael Streisguth, one more time. Again, Outlaw, Waylon, Willie, Chris, the Renegades of Nashville. Check this out from It Books. I'm telling you, you will call me and you will say, Tony, you were not lying. And you know I don't lie. As we come back with more on the other side after this.